Good morning. I normally say good morning to the Lindley Church that's scattered, not gathered, and to those outside the Lindley Church that are listening. I know of people in various parts of the country that have joined our service, so welcome. And one other word. After the message, since this is the first Sunday of the month and we observe the Lord's table on the first Sunday, we're going to take a minute and observe the Lord's table. So you might want to gather some pieces of bread and something to drink, and we'll observe the Lord's table. I want you to imagine two small children sitting in the kitchen, a boy and his sister. They're eating lunch, and on the counter is some candy. The mother says to the two, "You can have some candy after you eat your lunch, but not until." Then, during the lunchtime, she leaves the room for a minute, and the little boy slips out of his chair, walks over to the counter, and grabs a piece of candy. And in the process, the whole plate of candy lands on the floor. His little sister says, "That is not good." Now, I want to analyze what she said. It's true that it's not good. The candy landed on the floor, and after that you can't eat any of it. She didn't say it was a sin. She just said it was not good. Now, that interests me because as I've studied the book of Proverbs, I've noticed that there are times when Solomon says that that's good. But there are some times when he says that's not good. Now, what would you imagine Solomon would say is not good? Well, that's what I propose that we discuss today. Last time, I talked about goodness, all that Solomon said about what is good. And I defined goodness as, among other things, and it has a number of shades of meaning, but maybe the basic idea is being beneficial. Well, there are some things that are not good. They are not beneficial. The word also means pleasant. So there are some things that are not good, and they are not beneficial, and they are not pleasant. Now, what might those things be? Well, it's only a handful, but it's an interesting handful. I'm going to start with Proverbs 25:27. That proverb says, "It is not good to eat much honey. So to seek one's own glory is not glory." Now, of all the proverbs in the book, this one really struck me because it says, it's not good to eat much honey. Now, the real point of the proverb isn't about eating honey. The last part of the verse says, to seek one's own glory is not glory. So the idea is seeking to exalt oneself, seeking your honor, is as bad as overeating honey. But it's the overeating honey that got my attention. In the first place, I thought honey was good for you. As a matter of fact, I have had a problem with airborne allergies virtually all of my adult life. When the seasons change, I get the allergy. In the last few years, that has gotten less and less and less. Somebody told me if I changed my diet and ate a healthier diet, that would help, and it did. And then somebody told me if you consumed honey that was produced locally, it would help. And I've been doing that, and I think it's helped my allergy. So what's this thing about eating too much honey? You can see why it got my attention. Honey's good. It tastes good. I love the taste. Of course, I have a sweet tooth that has a bottomless pit in it. At any rate, I love honey, and sure enough, I looked it up. Honey is not only good for the taste, it's good for you personally because it has antioxidant in it and even some antibacterial properties. So it's good for you. But this verse says you can eat too much of it. And so I Googled that. How in the world do you figure out what's too much and why is it too much? And what I discovered is that, well, after all, honey is a sugar, and so too much sugar is not good for you. And that made me ask, well, how much is too much? And this is what I found. One site said 6 teaspoons, that's 2 tablespoons of honey per day, is the limit. And that's total sugar, not just honey. Then I found out the American Heart Association says that 9 teaspoons or 3 tablespoons per day for men is too much, and 6 teaspoons and 2 tablespoons per day is too much for women. I prefer that site because it got me more tablespoons of sugar, and I have a sweet tooth. Now, but the real issue is, he says too much is bad. So what I want to know is, what happens when you have too much honey? I didn't know. So I Googled it again. And what I found out is that too much honey can do all kinds of bad things for you. For example, it can cause diarrhea. It can cause vomiting. And it can cause nausea. I didn't know that. So I thought, all right, now I understand why he said too much honey is not good, because it can have negative effects on you. By the way, I have a friend, I've mentioned him before, who reads Proverbs, one chapter of Proverbs every day, and he's done it for years. And this week, he and I got into a conversation, and I was telling him about my little honey research, and he said, oh, and before I could tell him the negative effects, he said, oh, the book of Proverbs tells you what's wrong with having too much honey. And I said, it does? Where? And he said, well, it tells you in the book of Proverbs, if you have too much honey, it'll cause you to vomit. And I said, I've studied every verse in the book of Proverbs. Where's that one? I missed it, or at least I forgot it. Well, sure enough, Proverbs 25:16. Now, I read 25:27 in the same chapter. Solomon says, eat only as much honey as you need, lest you fill up with it and vomit. Would you look at that? Solomon figured that out, what, 3,000 years ago, roughly, that if you eat too much honey, it'll cause you to vomit. All right, but the point is that just as eating too much honey has negative effects, so boasting, seeking your own glory is bad for you. I saw an article in Psychology Today that described a fellow named Kyle, a graduate student finishing his MBA. The article said, and I'm quoting now, he celebrated every personal success with an all-out, no-holds-barred mission to spread the good news. We're talking about email blasts and Facebook posts, enthusiastic recaps for coworkers during a brief elevator ride, announcements to the acquaintance in the production aisle at the grocery store. As you can imagine, Kyle's self-promotion became a running joke among his fellow students. Extremely qualified, yet extremely annoying. If others perceived that Kyle was only interested in himself and his own accomplishments, they would naturally assume he didn't care about them at all. The article went on to say that he started to realize his never-ending sales pitch was hurting, not helping his case. And the article ended with this, quoting another author who said, "People will forget what you said. People will forget what you did. But people will never forget how you made them feel." Wow, that's interesting. But the point is that if you're constantly blowing your own horn or tooting your own horn, is that the expression? Or blowing your own whistle, it'll cause vomit. Perhaps other people to vomit. It will certainly cause them being nauseated, just like eating too much honey. By the way, the solution to this is given in another proverb. Proverbs 27 verse 2 says, "Let another man praise you and not your own mouth, a stranger, not your own lips." So, here's the first thing we learn. Let somebody else toot your horn. If you blow your whistle too much, that's as bad as eating too much honey. In other words, it's not good. The second thing I found that is not good is ignorance. Proverbs 19:2 says, "Also, it is not good for a soul to be without knowledge, and his sin who hastens with his feet." All right, this is an interesting little proverb in chapter 19. It's not good to act without knowledge. And then he goes on to say, acting hastily leads to sin. And apparently these two things are connected. If you lack knowledge, then you are more likely to make hasty decisions. And if you make hasty decisions, you're more likely to sin. You ever heard that expression, haste makes waste? Well, this proverb would say, haste makes sin. So the issue is, you don't have knowledge. What's the reverse of that? Get knowledge. Matter of fact, Solomon said that back in chapter 4. You ever heard of Steve Forbes, Forbes magazine? He ran for president once. Did you know that he's known for his proverbs, or at least his sayings? Matter of fact, if you Google him, there's one site that lists 89 of his proverbs. Some of them are kind of interesting. A promise made should be a promise kept. That's not bad. Then he said this, "As my father once said when he lost the governor's race in New Jersey, we were nosed out by a landslide." But one of my favorites is this one. He says, "The Declaration of Independence runs 1,300 words. The Constitution, which has served us for more than two centuries, comes to about 5,000 words. The Holy Bible has 773,000 words. The Federal Income Tax Code and all of its amendment rules and regulations has 9 million words and rising." Wow. That was, I thought, particularly fascinating. But the reason I brought him up is a week ago, on the way to church, I was listening to a broadcast, and he was being interviewed. And they were talking about the current situation, of course. But at the end of the interview, the interviewer said, "I know you're known for proverbs. What is your favorite proverb?" And I perked up and thought, oh, this ought to be interesting. And here's what he said, "With all you're getting, get knowledge." Now, that just happens to be, a quotation from the book of Proverbs in chapter 4, verse 7. So it is not good to lack knowledge. The reverse would be, it is good to have knowledge. And this is in the context of your spiritual life, because the last part of the proverb says, if you lack this knowledge, you're more likely to sin. You'll hasten to sin for your lack of knowledge. Now, all of that reminds me that in 2 Peter chapter 1, Peter says, add to your faith virtue, and to your virtue knowledge. You're not going to grow spiritually without the knowledge of God's Word. So a lack of knowledge, lack of knowing what God says, could very easily lead to sin. And that's the point Solomon is making in Proverbs 19:2. The third thing I discovered is that Solomon says dishonesty in business is not good. Proverbs 20:23 says, diverse weights are an abomination to the Lord, and dishonest sales are not good. In order to understand this proverb, you really have to understand what he means by diverse weights, as they, in the ancient world, measured things on a scale. And diverse weights meant that you had one weight when you bought something, and you had another weight when you sold it, so that you upped the price more. And so what he's saying, that's dishonest, and that is an abomination to the Lord. That word abomination appears a lot in the book of Proverbs. Remember what it means? It means repugnant, abhorrent, disgusting. So to cheat people in a business transaction is repugnant to the Lord. So this proverb is saying that deceptive weights are dishonest. Dishonest scales are not good. Matter of fact, they are repugnant to the Lord. Let me ask you a question. Is that a problem today? Is dishonest in business a problem? You ever been cheated? You ever been shortchanged in a business transaction? I guess the people that get blamed for this as much as anybody are mechanics that put parts on cars that you didn't need. But they're not alone. It happens all over the place. I've seen some material lately about hospitals who charge $25 for an aspirin kind of thing. Well, I read an article that really talked about this, and here's what it says. Honesty in business is desperately in short supply. Businesses topple due to dishonesty. Financial fortunes are compromised due to dishonesty. Business relations are fractured due to dishonesty. Dishonesty results in disaster. At times, such disaster can be averted. Sometimes dishonesty causes only small ripples, but dishonesty always has some level of collateral damage, an unfulfilled life, high levels of stress, and never being able to maintain satisfaction. Edson Spencer, the former chairman of Honeywell, said, and I quote, "The businessman who straddles a fine line between what is right and what is expedient should remember that it takes years to build a business reputation, but only one false move can destroy the reputation overnight." The books of business history are littered with remains of companies like WorldCom and Enron, whose leaders chose dishonesty rather than building a business empire with sound practices and strong ethics. They turned their companies into global laughing stocks. plunged millions into financial ruin, and ended up serving prison time for their ethics. Jordan Belfort, the famous, notorious Wolf of Wall Street, lived a dream of riches that was founded upon dishonest business. After the house of cards came crashing down, after he lost it all, after he ended up in federal prison, he wrote, "What I sincerely hope is that my life serves as a cautionary tale to the rich and poor alike." He was rich. He had yachts, mistresses, Ferraris, mansions, servants, and everything else he wanted. But in the end, he simply wanted his life to be a huge caution sign. Alan Horn, the chairman of the Walt Disney Studios, in a recent interview with Bloomberg, offered these six words as a summary of his ethics: never lie to anyone about anything. In other words, dishonesty in business is not good. Truth of the matter is, dishonesty in anything is not good, and the solution is be honest. Tell the truth. Deal honestly. The next thing I found, and this starts getting interesting, is that partiality is not good. In Proverbs 24, 23 to 26, Solomon says, "These things also belong to the wise. It is not good to show partiality in judgment. He who says to the wicked, 'You are righteous,' him the people will curse. Nations will abhor him. But those who rebuke the wicked will have delight, and a good blessing will come upon them. He who gives a right answer kisses the lips." Now, this is a passage that extends over several verses, but it comes down to this. Don't show partiality. The first part of the passage says that. It is not good to show partiality in judgment. And then it goes on to saying, he who says to the wicked, "You are righteous," that's partiality, then that person will be abhorred. And there's our word again, disgusting, detestable. On the other hand, he who rebukes the wicked, he says, will be a delight, and a blessing will come upon them. Now, I think this verse is primarily directed toward judges. It starts out saying partiality in judgment. So perhaps it's really aimed toward judges who say the wicked are righteous. And the point is, they will be cursed by the people and abhorred by the nations. On the other hand, judges who rebuke the wicked will have the delight of the people, and they will be blessed. Now, I think it primarily is talking about judges, but I think that this applies to people beyond that. Judges in the courtroom, politicians in public service, pastors in the pulpit, believers in the pew, and all of us in private life. Now, of all the things in the book of Proverbs of which it is said that's not good, this one gets three Proverbs. I mentioned one. Let me mention a second. Proverbs 18:5 says, "It is not good to show partiality to the wicked or to overthrow the righteous in judgment." Again, in the judicial case, we must not pay attention to a person's wealth or fame or influence or friends or their office. We must deal with justice, not partiality. To deal with partiality is a distortion of justice. Then there's a third proverb that again says, to show partiality is not good, because for a piece of bread a man will transgress. That's in chapter 28, verse 21. The last two Proverbs I've quoted begin with partiality. 18:5 says, it is not good to show partiality. 28:21 says, to show partiality is not good. So, the book of Proverbs pounds the pulpit on this particular thing. Don't show partiality. That is not good. This last one talks about don't show partiality. It's not good because for a piece of bread, a man will transgress. What in the world does that mean? Well, the little expression, a piece of bread, was proverbial for the most extreme point of poverty. And here, it probably is referring to a bribe. And again, the context is no doubt the judicial system. So he is suggesting that an unjust judge, a judge that shows partiality, would do it for a bribe, for trivial considerations, a mere bit of bread. It doesn't take much. The slightest motive will do. They would take a bribe consisting of a small bit of bread. Now, if there is anything we need in the judicial system, it is partiality, where you don't make the decision based on anything within that person, but objectively based on the law and the evidence. Do we not agree? But we've all heard cases where that is not the case. And I think that is the deterioration of our judicial system. Matter of fact, is there not a code against that? Is there not a law against that? So again, I did a little digging, and here's what I found. The code of conduct for the United States judges was initially adapted by the Judicial Conference on April the 5th, 1973. And it was known as the Code of Judicial Conduct for the United States Judges. The code applies in the United States to circuit judges, district judges, Court of International Trade judges, Court of Federal Claims judges, bankruptcy judges, magistrate judges, the appeals, the tax court, the Court of Appeals for Veteran Claims, the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces have adopted the code. The introduction to the code says this. It gives five canons. Canon one, a judge should uphold the integrity and independence of the judiciary. Canon two, a judge should avoid impropriety and the appearance of impropriety in all activities. Canon three, a judge should perform the duties of the office fairly, impartially, and dignity. Notice it's that canon that specifically says impartiality. Canon four, to finish the list, says a judge may engage in extrajudicial activities that are consistent with the obligations of judicial office. And Canon 5, a judge should refrain from political activity. But the reason I read this is Canon 3 says a judge should perform the duties of the office fairly, impartially. Now that goes for judges sitting on the bench. It goes for politicians. It goes for preachers in the pulpit. It goes for people sitting in the pew. It should go straight across the board. The scripture warns against partiality. Pastors are to preach the Bible. Doctors are to heal the sick. Judges are to be impartial. It is as wrong for a judge to be impartial as it is for a pastor to preach error, and for doctors to hurt someone instead of healing people. It is not good for preachers to preach error, for doctors to hurt, and for judges to be partial. We are to be impartial in our judgments. Now, the next thing I found in the book of Proverbs that is not good is in a sense related to this, and that is injustice is not good. Partiality leads to injustice. So Proverbs 17:20 says also, to punish the righteous is not good, nor to strike princes for their uprightness. Now, this verse has been interpreted several different ways because it mentions princes, and that word means noble. So some have taken this to mean noble in character are those who are princely in rank, and those are the two possibilities. At any rate, it's talking about treating people unjustly. As someone has said, perversion of justice takes place every day. It's not good to punish people for doing what is right. That's the point. Did you ever do something right and get blamed? I don't know what happened to me early in life, but this has been a particular issue with me. It hasn't happened very often, and I think I've gotten over it by now. But there have been a couple of times in my life when I did it right, and somebody blamed me for doing it. It just irritated the fool out of me. Well, that's a form of injustice. You ever had that experience? I think some children have it with their parents. As a matter of fact, I heard of a case like that recently, where no matter what the child did, it wasn't good enough. And that's just downright injustice. I read the story of a lady who said she worked for the county, not our county, but a county. And she said, "I am by far the most productive member of our department, just in terms of transactions. But my manager still complains about my output. She says, you should be able to do more work. You should be able to get more work done. I can't please her. No one else on our team accomplishes half as much as I do. And because our county pays scales, we get paid the same based on seniority, I get the same abuse even though I do more work." Which is a case of injustice. Doing it right and getting blamed for it. There's one more. There's one more proverb that says something is not good. Proverbs 16:29 says, "A violent man entices his neighbor and leads him in a way that is not good." Now, this one has some interesting ramifications. A violent man may entice his neighbor and lead him in a way that is not good. A violent man. The Hebrew word violent could simply mean wrong. It could mean unjust, but the idea of cruelty is in the word. So here is a violent, cruel person who is not content to sin himself. He wants to entice others and lead them in his way. He leads them in a way that is not good. The not good is obviously evil and destructive. He just wants to include somebody in his crime. Now, I've mentioned this several times as we're going through the book of Proverbs, but I think there are times when it's very helpful to remember that Solomon is writing this book to his son. And I can just imagine a father saying to his teenager or his a young man, now be careful. There's some people out there that will entice you and lead you in a way that is not good. Can you imagine a parent saying that? Can you imagine a parent not saying that? Well, it seems to me that that's the kind of thing that's going on. That it's easy for a teenager. Matter of fact, we've talked about the fact that the book of Proverbs talks about a simpleton, a naive person, which describes a young teenager, in my opinion, being enticed by a classmate or a friend to go do something that is wrong. I remember as a teenager being with a fella. I had a motor scooter. Sears used to make these little red motor scooters, and I had one of those. And we were out riding and stopped at a store, and he was shoplifting. It horrified me. But I could see, you know, that kind of thing happening. And Solomon says, don't do that. That be careful of the friend who will entice you into something that's not good. But what intrigues me even more is he said, this is a violent person. Is it possible that some are attracted to the very fact that the other person is violent? Perhaps they're angry, and the person being enticed is angry, and they identify with the anger. At any rate, he's talking about being enticed and not doing good. Now, Proverbs brings this very thing up and discusses it in detail in chapter 1. You might have heard me say that the first 9 chapters of the book of Proverbs are in paragraphs. Well, chapter 1 has a whole paragraph on this very subject. I'm going to read you part of what that paragraph says. Proverbs chapter 1, beginning at verse 10, says, my son, if sinners entice you, do not consent. If they say, come with me, let us lie in wait to shed blood. Let us lurk secretly for the innocent without cause. Let us swallow them alive like Sheol, that is the grave, like those who go down to the pit, that is the grave. We shall find all kinds of precious possessions. We shall fill our houses with spoil. Cast your lot among us. Let us all have one purse. I've read chapter 1, verses 10 through 14. But what he's talking about here, this is Solomon, and he says, my son, be careful. There are people that would entice you to do things that are not good. And the two things mentioned in this passage are murder. Matter of fact, he says, let us lie in wait to shed blood, and robbery. He talks about we will have their spoils. In other words, we're going to kill people in order to rob them. So, in chapter 1, Solomon proposes a scenario in which his son is enticed by sinners to participate in something that is really wrong. Murder and robbery. Those are crimes. And that's not good. And so he says, don't let them entice you. Now, I've explained this proverb in relationship to, say, teenagers or young people. But I think this applies to everybody, frankly. In the book of 1 Corinthians, chapter 15, verse 33, the Apostle Paul says, evil company corrupts good manners. Let me repeat that. 1 Corinthians 15:33. Evil company corrupts good manners. In other words, there are people who will entice you to do what is not good. Solomon said that, and Paul taught that. Be careful of who you allow to be your friends who influence you. Now, I've often said that when it comes to this subject, if you have friends and you are influencing them rather than influencing you, that's one thing. The line of demarcation is when they start influencing you negatively more than you influencing them. That's where you have to draw the line. So, there are times when you should say, I'm not going to be friends with this person because evil company corrupts good habits. I've done this several times in my life. I did it with that teenage fella who was shoplifting, and I wasn't even a Christian at the time. I just knew I didn't want to be in with him in some store and get nabbed for shoplifting. I also did it after I became a Christian and became friends with a fella that I thought was not having as good of influence on me as somebody else. And I actually switched roommates in college just based on this. So you got to be careful who your closest friends are. Now, you need to befriend everybody. I'm not saying that. Jesus ate with publicans and sinners, and we should do that. But be careful who you allow in that inner circle, the people that entice you to do that which is not good. Well, that's all I could find in Proverbs on not good. Did you learn anything? Any of that meaningful? Seeking your own glory. Ignorance. Dishonesty in business. Partiality. Injustice. Leading others into sin is not good. I can't help but wonder, Solomon has introduced us to an interesting category. In this series so far, I've talked about the wise and the fool. I've talked about the righteous and the wicked. And now I'm finishing that which is good and that which is not good. I've made the suggestion that these things overlap. I mean, what is righteous is wise and good, and what is foolish is sometimes unrighteous and not good. And yet I think there's a distinction between all of these. I think that we need to think sometimes in a category of just goodness. Righteousness has to do with measuring up to some kind of law or code. Wisdom is skill in knowing how to maneuver through things. Goodness is that has to do with being beneficial or not being beneficial. And when we looked at all those references to goodness last time, we saw that very often it wasn't good for you. I kept saying goodness boomerangs. So it's not just beneficial for somebody else. It's not beneficial for you to do certain things. But my point is, it seems to me that the book of Proverbs has opened up in my thinking another category, and that is goodness or not goodness. So I got done studying all this and I thought, what else would you add to this category? Could you think of anything else that you would say is not good? You might not put it in the classification of righteous or unrighteous, it's just not good. Can you think of anything? Well, I want to end by giving you a couple of suggestions. In this passage, He talked about a food that was good, honey, and said too much of it is not good. Could we then, based on that, apply this to say maybe there too much food is not good? Or too much of the wrong kind of food is not good? What would you put in that? How about junk food? And would that apply? Well, Solomon applied it to food. Now, this is getting too convicting, so let's move on to something else. How about money? We're in the middle of the coronavirus, and people are housebound, and I call it house arrest. We're handcuffed to our house. And what do you see on TV? Heartbreaking. Long lines of people standing and waiting for hours to get food. In America, over 30 million people have lost their jobs and don't have enough money to pay the rent and buy food. This is America. How does that happen? That happens in undeveloped countries, but in America? Now, I have a reaction to that. We ought to help these people. That's my first reaction. But as you know, I, for a short time in my life, was a stockbroker, a financial planner, if you will. Patricia and I got into that business because we wanted to do a seminar on teaching people how to handle money. And we ended up using the licenses that we got to teach seminars in churches on financial planning. Well, one of the things I learned is that any standard financial planner, a reputable financial planner, now there are people involved in the financial industry that are interested in selling you products, but a reputable financial planner, a bona fide financial planner, will tell you this: you need an emergency fund. You ever heard that? And you need in that fund 6 months of living expenses in cash. Now, financial planners are interested in helping you invest money for some future need like a wedding or college for your kids or retirement. But they know, this is their theory behind this suggestion, that if you invest money in the stock market and then you have an emergency and the market is down, it's no time to sell. So you need money in cash in case there comes an emergency and you need to get the transmission fixed on the car, replace the hot water heater or the roof on your house. And so they recommend that you have 6 months living expenses in cash. The other reasoning is that you could lose your job. And it would, hopefully, the idea is that hopefully within 6 months you could get another one. So you need money for living expenses. That is paying the basic bills like the rent or the mortgage or food, maybe the car payment, some of the bills. Now, there are some caveats to that. One of the things I was taught is that if there are two of you, if you're a married couple, and both of you have a job, maybe you could get by on 3 months. If you're self-employed, then they recommended a year. But the point is, you need money for an emergency, and most people in those food lines didn't have enough money for this emergency. I said most, probably all. Matter of fact, I've heard reports recently, over the last year or two, people say, most people do not have more than $500 in a savings account for an emergency. That's not good. That's not wise. I can't say it's not righteous, but I can say it's not wise, and I can say it's not good. And that's my point. This category ought to be applied to some of those other areas. Now, I think there are probably people listening to me who don't have a reserve account. So let me make a suggestion. When all this is over, start an emergency fund. And if by this time you're going to be so deep in the hole it's going to take a while, then do something simple like start with putting a small amount in an emergency fund. When Patricia and I were having these seminars, we said to people who sometimes were very poor, look, you need to learn the habit. Start with $5. Just put $5 a month and don't touch it. We sat down, I don't know with how many people, and said, tell us about your finances so we can help you. And they'd lay it out. Do you save money? Yes. And they would all tell us yes. Oh, that's very good. How much? And they'd give us a figure. $200 a month. Wow, that's great. How much money do you have in your savings account? $50. Well, now, wait a minute. I thought you were telling us that you put $200 a month in your savings account. We do. Well, then how do you only have $50 balance? Well, we take it out at the end of the month. Now, that is not good. Let me make one more suggestion. In the book of James, chapter 4, James says, to him that knows to do good and does it not good, it is sin. Only what he's talking about in that passage is the Lord. He's talking about making business plans and leaving God out of the business plans. So leaving the Lord out is not good. If you have never trusted the Lord, you need to do that. Don't leave him out of your life. All you have to do is realize he died for you, he arose from the dead, and trust him. Just trust him to give you the gift of eternal life, because he promised he would do that. So you take him at his word. Trust him to get you to heaven. You don't have to do anything. You can't. He did it all. Beyond that, if you're a believer, don't leave the Lord out of your life. That is not good. Put the Lord in your life and remember him constantly. It's not good to forget the Lord. There is a story of an ancient Persian prince who decided to accomplish all that he wanted to do. So he divided his life into four periods. He determined that the first period of his life would be given to travel. He designated the second period of his life for the affairs of state. He decided the third period of his life would be given to his friends. He dedicated the fourth period of his life to God. As the story goes, the prince died unexpectedly at the end of the first period of his life. His life was cut short. His well-laid plans were never fulfilled. The most significant thing about the story is the most important part of his life was neglected entirely. That's not smart. That's not good. He left God out. James says, that's not good. Matter of fact, that's sin. Don't wait till the fourth period of your life. Do that now. Father, thank you for these reminders that there are things that we allow in our lives that are not just wrong, they're just not good. They're not beneficial to others or us. So, Father, help us to think in those kind of categories and help us to put those good things in our life and eliminate the bad that are not good. In Jesus' name, amen.